Welcome to Let's Talk About It, co-hosted by Maria Wyatt and Scott Dudley. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.
Good morning and welcome. You're listening to Let's Talk About It, your voice for wellness here in the Imperial and Mexicali and San Luis and McCain and whatever other valleys you can hear us in. The land of valleys. My name is Scott Dudley, and I'm your host this morning. Maria is in the closet somewhere, and so you're riding alone with me today. And hope you have a great show. Hope you're having a great day. Hope you're enjoying the clouds. Cloudy with a chance of meatballs, as my 8-year-old pointed out this morning. This is the first cloudy day since we've seen the movie, so watch out. It's going to be raining spaghetti. 337-8874 is the phone number. Let's Talk About It again is the show. And I'm again Scott Dudley, your host. And I have a guest today, and he is joining us by phone. His name is David Lukoff. He is a psychologist, and he is heading up something called the Spiritual Competency Resource Center. And what we're going to talk today about is mental health and spirituality, which you can cover that in an hour, huh? Good morning, David. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good.
Good. Did you actually come back from Europe, or did you decide it was so much fun you stayed?
No, I am back here. I live in Petaluma, just a little bit north of San Francisco, and it's just a wonderful place to be. I always love coming back as much as I like to travel. So.
Well, let's kind of, I guess, jump in with both feet. What mental health and spirituality, or the spiritual components of mental health, maybe even, have really been a centerpiece of your life's study and work. Is that close enough?
It has been the focus of my professional and career, yes, absolutely.
And you have a dare I say, very unique, certainly not exceptionally unique, it's not an only story, but a unique kind of story of how you ended up deciding that that was really, really important to kind of show more learning and to bring into the field of mental health, the discussions of spirituality. Can we start there? How were your early 20s?
Well, I'll share that experience because it was what led me on this path. And I'll preface it by saying that now that I've been sharing it and out in the world more, and it has been over 8 years since this experience occurred, I have found many other people who have had very similar experiences. In fact, Friday and Saturday of this week, I'm going to be together with a group of consumers of mental health services, in a working conference to try to come up with a consensus statement about how what are the best ways to integrate intense spiritual experiences, because in fact many people have had similar experiences to the one I'll share and have also had problematic journeys as in the process of integrating them into mainstream culture. So my experience, it was the 1960s when this happened, although I'm saying that in a cultural sense because the actual year was 1971, but what we call the 60s was probably 1965 to maybe 1973.
The 60s were so good it took 2 years for them to wear off.
Yeah, a little late to start. People overslept, I guess, but yeah. Then I was a graduate student in anthropology at Harvard, and I was 23 years old and had just gotten my master's degree, and I had what I would term now as a kind of existential crisis, or maybe a late kind of identity crisis, in that I was living with a woman, and we were starting to talk about getting married and such, and I was about to start work on my PhD, which would have really set my career in concrete, and I just kind of freaked out. I just kind of had this overwhelming sense that I didn't really, on any deep level, know who I was. Here I was. I had really spent my entire life in school. I'd gone straight from high school to college to graduate school. Even most of my summers, I had worked in research centers or laboratories. And so I lived, in a way, a very sheltered life. And I had that deep sense. And I ended up rather precipitously, to my parents' dismay, dropping out of Harvard and starting to hitchhike around the country. And it was a very hospitable time to do that. I certainly would not want my kids to be doing that now. But in those days, it was almost like there was a highway of hippies, you know. I grew my hair long, and so some people would just honk and give me the finger, and other people would immediately stop and pick me up, and we'd have a great time going wherever it was I was going. And I was learning a lot about the world, and spent some time in Mexico, and spent some time in Canada, and ended up in San Francisco. And it being still culturally the 60s, somebody offered me a tab of LSD, and in my mind, being on the road to find out, some of you may remember that song from Cat Stevens, which kind of became a mantra for me. I was, you know, like almost singing it to myself constantly. I was on the road to find out. So being on this road to find out, I took the LSD with no preparation, no guide. I just took it. And during the day, I had a relatively benign experience. It was very pleasant. Colors were all enhanced, I felt very at peace. And I went to bed that night thinking, well, that was interesting, you know, I might do that again sometime, but certainly didn't feel like it had changed my life in any way. And the next day I got up and pulled out one of the books I had in my backpack that I had been trying to read but really had gotten nowhere with it, a book by Alan Watts on Zen and Enlightenment. And they'd always been reading like word salad to me, you know. I just couldn't make any sense out of it. All of a sudden, as I'm starting to look at this book, it made perfect sense. I understood exactly what Alan Watts meant by enlightenment and the social game that we're all playing and the need to see through it. And wow, that was kind of interesting that I all of a sudden understood this book. But I really didn't make much of it. I didn't even connect it to LSD or anything. 4 days later, I woke up in the middle of the night. I was crashing at an apartment where was I at that point? Staying with somebody in Palo Alto. And I just walked into the bathroom to urinate, and I looked in the mirror, and all of a sudden, my right hand was glowing. And I was holding it in what's called a mudra with my thumb and my forefinger creating a circle, kind of. And I looked at that hand glowing in the mirror, and I knew exactly what that meant. It meant that I was a reincarnation of Buddha. And then I had another insight, which was that I was also a reincarnation of Jesus Christ, and that I had been reborn to create a new world religion, that Buddha had created a religion for the East, and Christ had created a religion for the West, and my mission now was to create a new worldwide religion.
You know, Dave, you went from being a married doctor of anthropology to having to unite all of the religions in this overarching connection thing. That's quite an upshoot in responsibility. If you were trying to escape responsibility, it's like you're heading in the wrong direction.
That's true. But it's one of those experiences where I felt my whole life had been directed toward this. But, you know, my studies in anthropology, my undergraduate major in ancient civilizations, all of that had been to prepare me for this task.
Well, and typically when we come up with ideas or when we're just kind of trying to figure out stuff about ourselves even, it's, we don't really sit around and weigh whether or not the stuff's true or not, or whether it's accurate, or whether it's, it makes kind of any sense in sort of a, like, agreed upon reality way. And so I'm suspecting you probably didn't do much of that.
No, I didn't have any capacity for that kind of self-reflection at that point.
Well, when do we ask, you know, when I get up in the morning, I don't ask my friends if I'm doing the appropriate thing. I just can't go with it.
Right. And I might have been impervious to anybody else's input on this, because I was just so
lit
with this. It wasn't negotiable. And I just set about doing it. I just pulled out my diary that I'd been keeping and kind of converted it into this new holy book that I was going to write. And then started, for the next 5 days, hardly sleeping, you know, taking an hour nap here, an hour nap there, and having conversations not only with Jesus Christ and Buddha, but people like Plato and Rousseau, who wrote the book The Social Contract, which is how people live in society, because I was creating a new society. I wanted to know what the classic thinkers. Or I read that in college, so then I was consulting with him about how you would do this in the 20th century.
And this was before Wikipedia, so it wasn't, you know, you were actually consulting with him.
I was having conversations in my mind, literally back and forth conversations, also with Jung and Freud, and also with Bob Dylan and Cat Stevens, because it seemed to me that I wanted to know, they had been so successful in getting their word out into the mainstream culture that they would be useful people to advise me on this. So after 5 days, I had my 40-ish page holy book, and I Xeroxed up a bunch of copies, around 40 copies, and sent off a bunch to friends and family, and then went to Berkeley, and I thought of Berkeley as kind of the new Jerusalem, and I literally just started passing out copies in the street.
You know, Berkeley thought of Berkeley as the new Jerusalem, too. I think they may not, they may still hold that belief.
Well, it's funny, when I go back to the location where I was doing this, which was is on Telegraph, it looks almost the same. There are still the kind of hippie booths with people selling handmade jewelry and tie-dye shirts and all that, right? Same location, just like they were back then. And then, you know, in my mind, all I had to do was wait, and that soon I would be, you know, recognized as a kind of new prophet of this new global religion.
It was going to go viral before we had, like, that idea to describe it, huh?
Yeah, that was the idea, exactly, right, that one person would read it, you know, then pass it to a friend, not through the Internet, as you mentioned, that ink wasn't there, but, you know, primitive ways like mail and so on, and I thought it would travel around the world, and, you know, then this would come to be, that this new religion would take hold, and I would be the prophet of that. Well, you know, with that belief, I really didn't feel that I needed to waste my time, you know, making money or doing any of those kinds of things. And this is a, you know, something I still feel, you know, very lucky about, because I've met many people for whom this did not happen. But my friends really just kind of took me in, let me talk about this newfound thing that I was into, fed me, let me crash with him for a period of about 2 months. And I didn't have any money or anything. And I certainly now have met many other people in a similar situation who ended up on the street and ultimately ended up being hospitalized. I was allowed to kind of go through this experience, which is relatively rare these days. Most of the times, people with this kind of an experience end up in a hospital, medicated. And medication will take you down from this experience very quickly, but it doesn't give you the opportunity to kind of work through it. And now that I'm more of a psychologist, I know and believe that there's a natural healing cycle to this, that most people, if they're allowed to go through it, will complete that journey in something like 4 to 8 weeks. And there have been a couple of treatment centers. One was in San Francisco and one was in San Jose that are pretty well known, Diabasis and Soteria House. And they have closed down in the San Francisco area, although Soteria has a few treatment homes in Europe now, where people who are having a first psychotic break are allowed to go through that whole cycle without medication. And most of them will end up just fine and won't need lifelong medication and won't be stigmatized as a psychiatric patient and so on. And I just feel, you know, very lucky, and I have certainly made a point over the years of thanking my friends for doing that. There was a second part of that journey, because once I landed, I was extremely, you know, I was like, all of a sudden, looking back at my experience kind of the way anybody else would, I had no perception of this being a spiritual awakening or a spiritual emergency. That term wasn't even invented back then. So I just felt really embarrassed about it.
It's like the Emperor's New Clothes when the little kid says, "Hey, dude, you're not wearing any clothes."
Exactly. I just saw this like as one of the most foolish things I've ever done in my life. And
did that come on as quickly as the other state came on? Or did you wake up one morning and just like smell the coffee, or was this something that kind of gradually dawned on you?
Well, it was relatively gradual. There was a period of roughly a couple weeks where I found myself thirsty, much less just preoccupied with this idea that I was a prophet and I was founding a new religion. And that allowed other things to kind of infiltrate into my mind. Like, I started to realize, am I kind of loafing off my friends, freeloading off my friends here? You know, they're just beating me and putting me up. And, you know, I started to have some concerns about that. And there, relatively quickly after that, I started to look at this book I had written, and all of a sudden I started to say, well, really, I need to amplify that. It's not this perfect document that's, you know, ready for prime time. And I started to rip out pages and make notes like I was going to create a version 2.0.
Yeah.
And so on. So it kind of cracked.
Well, and when you were writing it and when you were kind of in that rarefied air, felt like prophecy. It felt like absolutely nailed down perfect.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
So you start coming back, and you've got this shame almost of, whoa. How did you cope with that and not either start taking lots of very strong drugs or maybe drinking, or how did you reintegrate, I suppose?
Okay, that's an important question, because I think that makes all the difference in the outcomes for many people, is how they do go about integrating it. Because I know I experienced embarrassment, which ultimately led to depression. I mean, I was really depressed, feeling like, you know, I was very foolish to do this. It was, I was foolish to drop out of Harvard, and I had just messed up all, you know, my life this way, and all full of regrets.
So not just that peak period of feeling that you were Jesus and Buddha, but this whole kind of journey of exploration of self.
Exactly, right. You know, I was sort of taking on the position of my parents that that was a mistake to drop out, and you know, just full of recriminations and so on. But, and I think this is a coping resource that I had, was I was also very curious about how this Jewish boy, I mean, I'd been raised in a very kind of secular Jewish household, so we were never members of a Jewish temple. But, you know, we celebrated like Hanukkah and Passover, but I didn't know Hebrew, I didn't know the Jewish prayers, and so on. So I never really identified strongly with being Jewish, but I was Jewish, I wasn't anything else. How, you know, could I have come to think that I was rooted in Christ, people about whom I knew nothing, really nothing? And so I started to read, and I started to read Joseph Campbell and Jung, and I started to kind of learn about spirituality and what it was, and could start to see that I was on a kind of spiritual journey in this, even if it had kind of, had thought my view at that point ended badly. So I was doing a lot of reading. I ended up during this phase in my parents' summer cottage, which was located in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. And it was a summer cottage, had no insulation, and I moved there in early March. So it was rather cold.
Chilly.
Yeah. But the town had a library, which I could use. And I had a lot of opportunity to kind of reflect on this. But that's, you know, where the recriminations also kind of set in. And I started to get kind of depressed about this all. I really, you know, had that deep feeling, you know, of having blown everything and so on. And I actually developed a recurrence of an illness that I had had about 10 years earlier called Crohn's disease, which involves internal bleeding within the intestines, the small intestines. And I went to a free clinic. I hitchhiked to a free clinic, and they gave me a bunch of pain medication. And a number of nights when I was having trouble sleeping, I was seeing what I took to be my own skeleton hovering above my body. And I seriously contemplated taking all of those sleeping pills, you know, and committing suicide. So I had gone from kind of a real high to this real low point. One day I was in the habit during the daytime of taking a walk along the beach, getting out of my cabin. On one of these walks, right around this time when I was seriously contemplating taking all this medication, I heard a voice. And it really was different from the voices that I described earlier, which were inside my mind. I was having internal conversations. Mm-hmm. This voice sounded like somebody had just yelled something at me. And I literally turned around to see if who was there. And there was absolutely nobody on this barren beach. And the voice only said one thing, and it said, "Become a healer." And I, you know, it was like, what? Become a healer? I mean, what does that mean in, like, 1971?
Nothing, the answer is nothing yet, because that hadn't commonly been a term used to kind of describe the bigger picture of what helper people do to other people.
Right.
I have to quickly reset. We are listening, you're listening to KUBL. This is Let's Talk About Your Voice for Wellness here in the Imperial Valley. Our phone number is 337-8874, and our guest today is Dr. David Lukoff, who is the head of the Spiritual Competency Resource Center. We're sharing his story right now, and we're going to shortly begin to talk about, I think, how mental health and spirituality intersect and what we can do not only in our community, but with the people that we work with who are going through a crisis somewhat similar to what David is sharing with us.
You're listening to Let's Talk About It, presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM Radio Bilingue.
Welcome back.
Yep, thank you. I'll finish up the story and.
Let's cut right back to this unit. So you've got a voice yelling at you on a chilly, kind of depressing Cape Cod beach. I mean, it's not like Ventura Beach or anything.
Hearing is, what happened was that voice that become a healer became like a mantra that I kept repeating to myself. As a question, you could almost say it was like a koan. What does that mean? What does it mean to become a healer? Does it mean go back to medical school? Does it mean study herbs? My mind just kept turning that over and over again. The very good thing about it was that it replaced all this kind of depressogenic thing. With, regrets and recriminations and feeling foolish. I just kept thinking about what does this mean? So it was a very future-oriented kind of thing to become healer. And my parents, at that point, I was also still fit. I was no longer feeling suicidal, but I was still physically fit. And I asked my parents if I could come and return home because they lived fairly near New York City, New Jersey, and I thought, well, that would be a better place to explore some of these possibilities. And they, said sure. They welcomed me home. Grateful to them for that, and again, kind of supported me. And then starting to unravel this with taking classes. I took classes in yoga. I took a class in herbs, and I took a class in counter groups. And that's what really grabbed me. And so I took an additional couple of courses and then ultimately a 6-month training program in how to become a group facilitator. And then I ended up doing that kind of work, facilitating counter groups, growth groups, transactional analysis, gestalt, psychodrama. And ultimately that's what led me into the field of psychology. And I'll just mention two other quick things that were part of my integration. And one was going into Jungian analysis, where I learned kind of view that episode in my life as kind of like a dream, where there were symbols, and I learned Jung viewed Christ as a kind of archetype of the ideal self. And, so that made sense to me. It didn't validate my experience. It kind of showed me that it was a part of my unconscious that was speaking to me. And ultimately, in my view of this experience, it was my spiritual awakening. It was a part of my life that I had been totally ignoring, and it was kind of coming and kind of grabbing me and saying, hey, pay attention to this. The other thing that I had the opportunity to do was to work with a Native American, they don't use the term shaman, but medicine man.
Mm-hmm.
And as I worked with him, there was a point at which he confided to me, as I was sharing part of this experience, that he had also had a similar experience in his early 20s that landed him in a psychiatric hospital. So it then sort of triggered the idea or validated the idea that this was kind of a calling. But that's how he viewed it. He viewed it as a calling. And so I started to feel much less embarrassed about it. It gave me the courage to actually talk about it and write about it. And I ultimately wrote an account of this experience that I published in a magazine called Shaman's Drum. And that led to what you wanted to then talk about, which is I started to do work with other people having similar experiences, both in psychiatric hospitals and through something called Spiritual Emergency Network, which was in effect, a network of therapists who were available to help people through these kinds of experiences so that they didn't end up in the hospital.
You know, David, on one hand, I'm thinking, I got some questions I want to go into, but on one hand, I'm still kind of thinking back on that beach. We're really fortunate that the voice from the universe didn't yell, you know, form a boy band and call it NSYNC or something odd like that. Kind of got you going in the right direction. So I'm curious, from your perspective of what you've gone through, do you think that what you went through is exceptional from what we consider to be a first-time psychotic break, or do you think that what you went through was par for the course, basically?
I do think that a fairly high percentage, I mean, I don't know if it's 50%, 30%, or some people would say 90% of people having first psychotic breaks are having these kinds of inner journeys, which if people are provided the kind of treatment that I was allowed, you know, just a lot of support, and maybe even additionally, which I didn't have, guidance through this, that they could land on the other end without any need for hospitalization or medication. So there's a fair number of people. I've met people in that situation. I now work clinically with people in that situation, and I work with the Spiritual Emergency Network, and I'm now working in a project here in California. California has become very progressive in the area of spirituality, and there's a group of consumers that I'll mention. The main ringleader of this, his name is Jay Mahler, who has he was leading spirituality groups for consumers back in the 1970s. And has been really pushing the idea that spirituality is an important part of recovery. He would also argue that if you are able to work with this dimension earlier, you might even prevent people from becoming patients in the first place, and I really agree with that. But right now, there are a number of people who have had similar experiences that are being ignored or pathologized by the mental health system. You know, it's being, Freud is famous for saying that religion is an illusion, it's a form of obsessional neurosis, and anybody who went through conventional training, like me and most of mental health professionals now working in the field, were basically trained in that field. And now, through Jay's initiative that now has gotten funding and that I'm working with, and number of other people I'm working with, we're trying to make a place for spirituality in the mental health system and in recovery. And we have a website I'd like to mention.
Certainly.
www.mhspirit.org. And we've held a couple of conferences, and we have recorded the presentations from these conferences, and we put those up online, and we've put up a number of other resources for people who are at that phase of integrating these kinds of experiences, or who are working with people integrating these kinds of experiences.
You know, it occurs to me that, you know, psychology is almost grounded in the idea of some sort of objective reality, or maybe we would call that consensual reality, where we can all kind of agree on what's happening, you know, at any given time. How do you begin to allow for non-ordinary experiences or non-consensual reality and somehow avoid pathologizing that and calling that some sort of disorder that needs some sort of aggressive chemical reactive treatment?
Yeah. Well, there has been a sea change in healthcare in general over the last, I guess we go back at least 10, maybe 15 years, in reversing the view that religion and spirituality are forms basically of pathology, which was, you know, the Freudian view. It was the view also of other pioneers like Albert Ellis, the C.F. Skinner, and so on. What's really changed the view of psychology, psychiatry, and healthcare in general is the extensive research, now over 2,000 articles, showing that actually religion has health benefits for people, that people who are spiritual or religious actually have better outcomes from depression, from even from surgery. They have lower rates of substance abuse, lower rates of depression. So now, spirituality is acknowledged within the mental health system as a resource for people. So that there has been a change in this, and there's also even an acknowledgement in the diagnostic system. If you Google my name, probably what would come up is something about the DSM-4. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual,
mm-hmm.
which lists about 385 diagnoses. And I was involved with a couple of other people, Francis Liu and Robert Turner, in proposing a new diagnostic category back in 1994 that was accepted, called Religious or Spiritual Problems. So there's now a place in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for people to recognize that people can have spiritual problems, like the one I had, that are not pathological. So that's, I think there has been a change in the whole way that mental health system now views spirituality, although you have a lot of people who were trained in the kind of previous generation of perspective on this and really are ill-equipped for, you know, to even talk to people about religion or spirituality. And that's one of the things that I'm now working with on this initiative, and I do teach workshops on spirituality. Sometimes they're very focused, like my wife is a hospice social worker, and she and I did a workshop together on spirituality in death and grief, which we teach at UC Berkeley and some other places. So it's a way of really training people who have not been trained prior to this new generation in how to work with spirituality. So I'm actually very optimistic. I think these are really good times for these kinds of more accepting and supportive approaches toward people who are having intense spiritual experiences.
You know, it occurs to me almost that you know, if you look back in the history of astronomy, for example, and when they were measuring the orbits of certain things, the orbit wasn't coming out exactly right, and because of that, they were able to begin to imply that there were other things there that were affecting the orbits, but they didn't yet have the tools necessary to really measure those things or understand what it was. It occurs to me that the same might be said for the internal universe of and spirituality, that if we've got 2,000 studies that indicate that there are all these effects of this thing that we haven't quite got our hands on how to measure yet or how to objectively prove, that maybe that alone is enough to understand that it is there, and eventually the tools catch up to the knowing, and we have ways to measure this, you know, later on. But right now we can begin to work with an assumption that spiritual basis can have some protective or supportive factors in life.
Yeah. And it's interesting that medicine has embraced this much more quickly than has psychology and social work and mental health in general. And I think it's because physicians acknowledge that what they do is both an art and a science, and it gives them more latitude. So over two-thirds of medical schools now include courses on religion and spirituality, and there's a spirituality assessment interview that is routinely taught now to physicians so that they're comfortable asking their patients about, you know, what gives, you know, whether they're connected to a religious or spiritual group and whether that's important to them, and is there anything that the physician should know about their beliefs that would affect their treatment, so on. That's routine now. And if you're admitted to a hospital, they will ask you, you know, do you have a faith or religious practice, or, you know, it's routine. Whereas psychology likes to think of itself more as a science, and for them, it's actually quite a bit more difficult in their paradigm to acknowledge this area, although that's changing too. And the American Psychological Association now has published a number of really good books on spirituality and psychology and spirituality and psychotherapy and so on. So the mental health field is behind medicine, but it's catching up.
Oh, and I guess just thinking about it, I would say maybe psychology as an institution might be more easily threatened by, it's almost a competing institution in some regards, because there are faith-based ways of managing depression, and there are faith-based ways of dealing with anxiety that are, or in other mental health types of problems, that are sometimes kind of like almost contraindicated in terms of the field of psychology and the way that medical model's kind of grown out of itself. And
yeah.
I think maybe there's a little, you know, natural hesitancy to begin to say, well, okay, there maybe is one more than one way to skin a cat. The other thing that jumps out at me is, you know, you have many in the field of psychology who do have strong spiritual bases personally, including yourself. How has it been for that population, the therapists and the psychologists and others, to begin to integrate spirituality into the field of mental health? Is that a challenge, or is that something that's just happening really smooth? You know, how's that going?
You know, I think that our whole culture is kind of undergoing a spiritual awakening. I think the economic hard times kind of turn people inward and into their own resources and exploring their own spirituality. And that certainly seems to be happening among psychologists and social workers and MFTs and the mental health field in general. And so I think there are surveys showing that most mental health professionals do say they have a form of personal spirituality. Where there is a gap is that most psychologists, unlike the general population, are not members of organized religion. So sometimes there's a gap there in appreciating the importance that a person's faith can have when it expresses itself in the form of membership in a church. But psychologists and other mental health professionals now, the vast majority of them do view themselves as having a personal form of spirituality. So that can be the work that I do when I give, like, workshops, continuing education workshops for mental health professionals. That becomes our starting point, is in the area of spirituality. And then we expand upon that and make a bridge from personal spirituality to organized religion, so that it encompasses where the majority of people in the United States really are.
Well, almost everyone's somewhere on that spectrum.
Right. And the Gallup polls are showing that the largest group right now are people who are defining themselves as spiritual, but not religious. But there's still, you know, that's about 30%, and then there's like 40% who say they're religious but not spiritual.
Mm.
So there's some tension in that, but it's a workable tension, I think.
And
it's ripe for dialogue.
To me, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the therapy room, in the process of deciding. I mean, I can remember the initial thrust towards cultural competency as it related to ethnicity.
Right.
And it started fairly heavy-handed in terms of you could define cultural competency by what language somebody spoke. And if you could speak their language, you were, quote-unquote, culturally competent. And it didn't really kind of look very carefully at maybe some of the subtleties involved in culture. It's begun to grow past that point, certainly. I'm wondering how this is going to play out with spirituality.
Well, you know, you mentioned the main mechanism by which I think spirituality now is getting accepted within the larger healthcare and mental health care systems, which is as a form of cultural competency. And just as cultural competency is becoming more differentiated and sophisticated and you're absolutely right. It started off with a very simplistic idea that, well, if you're the same ethnicity, then, you know, that's where the cultural competency comes in, and now we realize that it's much more complex than that. Cultural competency is a broad area that allows professionals to work with a wide variety of people because there's a need to do that. There are people who work within a limited ethnic area, and there's people who work in, say, a church-based counseling center where everybody they work with is of the same religious faith. But that's hardly the norm. The vast majority of people in healthcare are working with are very multicultural population. And the project that I mentioned earlier, that spirituality initiative, is actually housed within the Center for Multicultural Development here in the state of California. So we've been kind of hitching spiritual competency onto the multicultural competency bandwagon, and it's a really good fit, and it is now being acknowledged as just as important as ethnicity and race and language and so on as a form of diversity.
Nice. If for people in our community, and we're kind of at the end of our hour, but for people that are in our community that might be more interested in this, could you go ahead and throw out your websites and your information again so that they can find this stuff and follow up on it and be a part of this kind of change in consciousness?
Okay. Well, I do have a website where I try to keep track of a lot of these kinds of issues and what the resources are, and there is such a wealth of resources now of both journal articles that are up online for free, podcasts, video. It's just quite amazing. And my website is www.spiritualcompetency, and that's all one word, spiritualcompetency, run together, .com. And then the Spirituality Initiative here in California is www.mhspirit.org.
Great. Thank you, David. And thank you for coming aboard today. We didn't light up the phone lines, but that's partly my fault because I didn't keep giving out the phone number every 30 seconds because it kind of cuts into the narrative time. But we appreciate coming aboard today and wish you all the best in all of your work here. And you know, it occurs to me that in some odd way, what you're doing may be kind of also playing itself out in terms of what happened to you that summer a long, long time ago in San Francisco.
Well, I'm on a mission.
All bets aren't in yet.
Well, thank you, Scott. I enjoyed talking with you.
I appreciate it very much. Thanks again. And this is Let's Talk About It, your voice for wellness here in the Imperial Valley. And just a quick reminder, if you liked today's show or want to share it with people, we got our producer, Mario Espinosa, is going to slap that bad boy together and edit out all of my faux pas and get it up on the website at KXO where it's under Let's Talk About It. And you can go ahead and access that and click on it and get more of David Lukov. The other thing, of course, is to contact him, or if you want to, contact Behavioral Health 760-482-4000. Certainly they'd be happy to route you to wherever your curiosity takes you. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week. We'll be back. We'll have more. Let's Talk About It. Enjoy the rest of your week.
You've been listening to Let's Talk About It, heard each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM, Radio Bilingue. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.